Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in a case that will determine whether the abortion pill mifepristone remains legal. The plaintiffs are a group of anti-abortion doctors who do not prescribe mifepristone. Medication abortion now accounts for 63% of all abortions performed in the U.S., according to the Guttmacher Institute. The majority use mifepristone, which was first approved by the FDA in 2000 and is highly safe and effective, according to numerous studies. Slate's Dahlia Lithwick and Mark Joseph Stern write, "This case is about a handful of physicians seeking to wield their, quote, conscious objections to abortion as a cudgel against everyone's access to safe reproductive care throughout the country." So it was heartening to see that the majority of the Supreme Court does not have the conscience to take it seriously. It was harrowing, however, to hear at least two justices embrace the plaintiff's foundational theory that a long defunct federal law already bans medication abortion and maybe procedural abortion as well, and that the courts can revive this ban once they get their hands on the right case. Rolling Stone's Tessa Stewart writes, "It may not matter how the high court rules if Republicans win the presidency in November. That is because GOP operatives have already crafted an expansive blueprint, 887 pages long, laying out in painstaking detail how they intend to govern, including plans to leverage virtually every arm, tool, and agency of the federal government to attack abortion access. The document explicitly names their intention not just to rescind FDA approval of the abortion pill, if they regain control of the White House, but to revive a 150-year-old law that criminalizes sending or receiving through the mail any article, instrument, substance, drug, medicine, or thing that could be used to facilitate an abortion. That law, the Comstock Act, is viewed as a de facto federal abortion ban by reproductive rights advocates and anti-abortion activists alike." On today's Your Call, we will talk about the anti-abortion groups behind the Supreme Court case, and then really the end game for the Republican Party to ban abortion in all 50 states. We'll follow the money, and we'll talk about where the fight for reproductive justice goes from here. Unsev Demerhun is a senior researcher at True North Research, an investigative research watchdog. Unsev wrote a piece about the Charlotte Lozier Institute, a group at the center of the retracted mifepristone studies. Hi, Unsev. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. We are also joined by Crystal Littlejohn and Ricky Solinger, editors of Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. It's a new collection of essays that documents what people are doing to protect abortion access on the ground. Crystal Littlejohn is associate professor at the University of Oregon. Her work examines race, gender, and reproduction. Her latest book is called Just Get on the Pill, The Uneven Burden of Reproductive Politics. She's also a series editor of the Reproductive Justice book series from UC Press. Hi, Crystal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Ricky Solinger is a historian whose work focuses on reproductive politics. She's also author or editor of many books, including Wake Up, Little Susie, Single Pregnancy, and Race Before Roe v. Wade. She's senior editor of the Reproductive Justice book series from UC Press. Ricky, we had you on a couple of years ago, so it's nice to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Great to have you back. Well, Unsev, let's start off with you, because I think it's so important to talk about the groups that are behind the Supreme Court case and all of the money. And you write extensively about this, about Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life, the Charlotte Lozier Institute, the Alliance Defending Freedom. And they all have financial ties to either the Federalist Society's Leonard Leo or the oil mogul Charles Koch. So can you first tell us, what groups do we need to be paying attention to?
Yes, of course. That's a great question. You certainly need to be paying attention to the two that you just mentioned, Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America, as well as their research arm, Charlotte Lozier Institute. But in addition to that, several of the dark money groups that are in Leonard Leo's orbit filed amicus briefs in yesterday's case. And some of those include Students for Life of America, where Leonard Leo sat on the board for several years. He's recently no longer on the board. Catholic Vote, Concerned Women for America, Life Legal Defense, and Family Research Council. And then so many more. And then when it comes to the actual plaintiffs, Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, that is an umbrella abortion group. And within that umbrella abortion group are other groups like Catholic Medical Association with financial ties to potentially to Leonard Leo through donor advised funds, ties to one of Leonard Leo's associates, Neil Corkery, who is in charge of the $1.6 billion Marble Freedom Trust, the books for that, the bookkeeping. But the person that keeps coming up is Leonard Leo, right? And so I think that he's really at the center of this court capture. I mean, this is a man who handpicked the justices who overturned Roe. Leo and his dark money court capture network spent $600 million to capture the court. And that is in addition to the $1.6 billion Marble Freedom Trust that was given to him by anti-abortionist industrialist Barry Side. And so I think what's really important about this case, in addition to paying attention to who the names are, who the groups are, who the people are, is that this case should have never made it to the Supreme Court. It's largely based on discredited claims from a group created solely to ban abortion, using litigation through a court system that's been captured by right-wing dark money groups and special interests. And like I mentioned earlier, the center of that is Leonard Leo. And I think often what's overlooked by some, at least, is that Leo and his network have spent decades maneuvering to stack our courts with right-wing judges in order to help fulfill their regressive agenda. And it's an agenda that the majority of Americans do not agree with. And now what we're seeing is this is the incredibly poisonous fruits of their labor in the form of extremist groups making use of the courts Leo captured to ram through coordinated campaigns against reproductive rights. And, the fact that the far-right faction dominating the Supreme Court is considering this outrageous effort by anti-abortion zealots to ban the mailing of abortion medication that the FDA has approved as safe based on numerous independent and peer-reviewed studies is just further evidence of how politicized and corrupted the federal judiciary has become due to Leonard Leo, his billionaire backers, and his court capture scheme. And, based on yesterday's hearing, I can give you one concrete example of what I mean by this. So yesterday, Justice Alito referenced a mifepristone study that was retracted earlier this year because it lacked scientific rigor. And it was also retracted because the lead author failed to mention a major conflict of interest, and that is that he works for the Charlotte Lozier Institute, which is the research arm of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, which is an anti-abortion group, an incredibly well-funded anti-abortion group. But it gets even better. That group has, that he's employed by, has received millions of dollars from Leo's network over the years. And we see this time and time again with these court cases.
And Sev, what's very concerning is that, first of all, a lot of this is head spinning. I mean, there are so many organizations here. A lot of people have probably never heard of Charlotte Lozier. To follow the money is so important, but it's very rare to hear this in the major media coverage. I mean, I watched the Sunday shows. I listened to radio pieces about the case yesterday. None of them mentioned any of this. First of all, why do you think that's the case, and why is it so important to follow the money and talk about these groups?
It'd be difficult for me to say why certain media outlets are not covering it or using the dark money lens to cover abortion access cases. What I can say is that, there are a number of phenomenal journalists that are covering Leo, dark money groups, and the use of that money to manipulate our judicial system. And some of those include Heidi Presvilla from Politico, Andrew Perez from Rolling Stones, Jane Mayer from New Yorker, Ann Nelson, Sean Boberg, and Isaac Stanley Becker from The Washington Post. And then our team also contributes quite frequently our research to Truth Out and Miss Magazine. And you really can't overlook the amazing reporting that ProPublica has done on the dark money and the corruption of the court system. Now, I think that it's so important to follow the money because following the money oftentimes gives us an understanding of how these networks are connected to one another, how they might potentially be coordinating with one another, because we keep seeing the same bad actors over and over again. And exposing the money, which is oftentimes an astronomical amount, resonates with people in a way that I think gets them to pay attention to abortion access in a really profound manner, because there is this huge, well-financed effort to eliminate our freedoms, our reproductive freedoms.
Crystal, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, thinking about all of the essays in the new book that you edited with Ricky Solinger, Fighting Mad, where people are on the ground fighting for basic healthcare and basic reproductive access. And yet they are up against people who are very well funded. I mean, multimillionaires, as Ansev just pointed out, Leonard Leo's network raised $600 million to pack the courts. So what would you add about the importance of following the money and talking about these organizations?
In addition to following the money, I think it's really important to follow and honor the abortion rights and reproductive justice activism that is taking place in the context of the assault on abortion that we see happening every day. Our book shows that there are so many people that are fighting, that are committed, that are really dedicating themselves to their communities and to their organizations to make sure that even as everything is going on around us, that they're doing their best to provide people with access to abortion, whether that be abortion travel, whether that be providing information on resources that people can get so that they can receive the abortion care that they need. That can be making sure that folks know about different campaigns that are taking place that they can participate in. It can also be just shedding light on the different barriers to abortion that existed even when Roe was the law of the land. And so one of the things that gives me a lot of heart is knowing that even as we see these attacks taking place, even as we see people that are unjustly encroaching on people's right to have an abortion, to get medication abortion, there are also people who are fearlessly fighting against that and are fearlessly doing their whatever they can to make sure that the people who are unjustly launching these attacks have to face some resistance and have to really reconcile with the people that are out there doing whatever they can to make sure that those folks don't win.
Hello?
I'm sorry, I had a technical issue there. Ricky, can you also jump in? What would you like to add?
Yeah, I would like to add that I noticed yesterday that the University of California Press is calling our book, Fighting Mad, a field guide to abortion activism, which I think is a great way of thinking about what the book does and also what's going on out there in the world. And it makes me think that, you know, I'm a historian, so historians claim not to be able to predict the future, but we know about the past. And, you know, in some ways, listening to the description of the dark money makes me think of, say, the 1960s, when the John Birch Society and all of its right-wing anti civil rights and white supremacist organizations aligning with it were existing simultaneously with the civil rights movement. I mean, this is the nature of America. When there is a critical mass of people pushing for justice and pushing for equality of various kinds, there will be this dark money in the background trying to dismantle, attack, and destroy these progressive movements. So in some ways, this is nothing new, but it's really important, I think, to see what's happening right now as an expression of profound frustration, not only of the amassing of endless amounts of money, but an expression of profound frustration with the loss of definition of what women are and an interest among these people in reconstructing this frayed, in fact, possibly ruined idea of who women are. And they want to enforce and coerce reproduction. You know, you get pregnant, you have sex, you get pregnant, you will have a baby. And that's something which has fallen away and been redefined so profoundly in the last 50 years. And what it takes to be a dignified person in the United States today, able to manage one's own body, is profoundly under assault. And we know in this country, as do all the people who contributed to fighting MAD, resisting the end of Roe v. Wade, know that being able to manage your own body is a foundational aspect of the being a citizen in this or any other country where citizenship is possible, full citizenship. So what these people want is to bring women back to a Comstock era or at least 1950 definition. But I just want to say one more thing about the pill debate that we saw played out in the court yesterday, which is that the evidence such as it exists of the last criminal era demonstrates that no matter what the law said, hundreds of thousands of women every year sought out and got criminal abortions. And in fact, some of the estimates by experts who were public health people watching these things in the past said that the number of abortions that occurred in the last criminal era was about equal to the number of abortions that were done every year in the first years after Roe v. Wade. Because when you criminalize an activity which is necessary to the lives of so many people, it will continue to occur. And that's why Plan C and all the other people who are managing the distribution and the information and materials to do self-managed abortion say, look, the pill is here. It has arrived and it will not go away. So the Comstock Law, notwithstanding, the contemporary millions, billions of dark money, notwithstanding, the pill is here.
And Sev, what are your thoughts about the end game here for the GOP? We've talked about Project 2025 on the show several times. I mentioned the article that was in Rolling Stone by Tessa Stewart, who says that, you know, if Trump wins in November, I mean, they're going to obviously go after contraception. They're going to use the CDC to increase abortion surveillance and data collection, punish states that require health insurance to cover abortion. So what do we need to know about what their plan is in the coming months?
Yes, absolutely. Such an important question. And while I can't speak to the intent of the GOP moving forward, I think they've made it very clear through their concerted effort to rid of of abortion access on multiple fronts, you know, post-Dobbs. I think that, you know, they're not hiding these actions. It's pretty much available for anyone who's paying attention. And so I would say the most important thing to do is actually pay attention. And you mentioned Project 2025, which is organized by the Heritage Foundation, which has received lots of money from the same people that are funding these anti-abortion efforts. I think it's important, while Americans don't have to read all 881 pages of it, it's important to familiarize yourself with the synopsis of this report, which is basically suggesting a very regressive policy that would affect every facet of our lives. And, you know, in addition to Project 2025, there was a really amazing interview that was conducted by, I believe, Ian Ward at Politico, where the head of Alliance Defending Freedom, Kristen Wagner, said, "Let me be even more clear. I'm far more excited about having a culture where abortion is unthinkable than necessarily having one where it is not legal. Unthinkable means that we have fixed the social ills that are plaguing our society, and we're creating families and helping families to flourish." Now, Alliance Defending Freedom was the legal counsel for the plaintiff in the Mifflin Prestone case. They will also be representing Idaho in the upcoming EMTALA case. And this is their CEO that's blatantly saying that for them, the end goal is having a culture in which abortion is unthinkable, not having a society where committing rape and or incest is unthinkable, but instead where abortion is unthinkable. And so these people are, I would say, because of this dark money system, the support of Leo and other bad actors like Coke and others, you know, are emboldened in this moment. And I think the Dobbs win really emboldened them. And it was just the beginning and certainly not the end for attacks on abortion access. And I think, you know, the United States has one of the worst maternal mortality rates in the developed world. And when we should have been moving the needle towards true reproductive justice and fighting for things like, you know, paid family and medical leave, what we did was, you know, overturn Roe. And abortion access is just the bare minimum. And it seems like for these groups, eliminating, you know, federal protections for abortion access was just the start. And I think every American needs to recognize that.
Unsev Demerhan is senior researcher at True North Research. We're also joined by Krista Littlejohn and Ricky Solinger, editors of the new book, Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts about where we are right now? The reality on the ground, we've done so many shows about what is happening to people who are trying to get healthcare and abortion access. And then you have so much activism happening at the same time. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I guess I have the question of why. Why are people like Trump, who clearly doesn't care one way or the other about abortion, and all the other rich people who have wives who would love to be able to get abortions when they want, care about abortion? And why, what is motivating the anti-abortion movement? In other words, how does it benefit capitalism? With Trump, you can understand why capitalists are supporting him. He wants to increase their profit. But how does the anti-abortion movement help capitalists?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think about this all the time. He's managed to put such a wide coalition together. Unsev, I know we have to let you go, so do you want to take that first?
Sure, but I do think that Crystal and Ricky might speak to this a little bit better, but I can definitely take a shot. I think that, you know, there is a lot of power within the anti-abortion movement. And we see it in the form of these dark money groups like Susan B. Anthony, Students for Life of America, and others. And they have a lot of financial backing. And for me, the way that I would see it is that Trump's, you know, position on abortion is kind of contingent on where he can have the most access and closest proximity to power. And so in a political context where far right is really galvanized and asserting themselves in fundamental ways that are changing our democratic landscape, I think that Trump's alignment with a more conservative abortion policy is really a power play. Mm.
Well, Unsev, I know we have to let you go. So thank you so much for your work. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Unsev Demerhun is senior researcher at True North Research, an investigative research watchdog. And you can find all of the work she's done about exposing the groups behind the anti-abortion movement. And she also follows the money. So many of these groups are directly connected to the Federalist Society's Leonard Leo. Crystal, what are your thoughts on Lisa's question?
It's fundamentally about control, and it's longstanding. So we know that if we think about what's happening with the Comstock Act, this is a law from 1873, and it's still on the books, even though it's not enforced. And this law, even so long ago, criminalized trying to use the Postal Service to, quote unquote, send obscene materials. And that included things like contraceptives, substances, or things that could induce abortion, but also things like things considered pornographic, and the materials that were written about those kinds of things. And so even though we see this being invoked in the current context, it is really something that deals with trying to control the ways that people who can get pregnant live their lives. I think one of the goals is to fundamentally remove access to the very tools that give people who can get pregnant and give birth control over their lives and their families. Obviously, it's unconscionable. It's about limiting access to contraception for young people. It's about encroaching on contraceptive access to IUDs, for example, through some of the misinformation out there about it. And obviously, it's about trying to ban abortions, and in fact, banning abortions for many people. And so even though I think we see this as a contemporary manifestation, or we see this in the contemporary manifestation of what's going on right now via the different kinds of narratives that are being used, the false claims that are being made, the efforts to control and limit people's access to such important life-saving tools is very long-standing, and it reflects the history in the United States of politicians and others seeking to take control over or seeking to take control from the people who have a right to live their lives the way that they want to and have a right to healthcare and to care that they feel and is in fact necessary to create the families that they want to create when they want to create them, and to prevent pregnancy when they don't want to have pregnancies. And so it's something that is so frustrating and angering to see pop up over and over and over again, because as I said, even though we're seeing the way it's showing up today, as a sociologist who looks at these issues within social and historical context, it's a pattern that reoccurs over and over again, over centuries of time in the United States.
Ricky, what would you add?
Well, I think that question really is a massive cosmic question, because the issue of why Donald Trump has become the focus of American politics at the time that he became the focus and remains the focus. So why do so many Americans, and we'll find out whether it's a critical mass, continue to support him, and why and how he continues to feed the interests of his base. And his base, as we understand it, is a collectivity of people who wish to resuscitate and sustain traditional gender and racial roles in the United States according to their identities in the 19th century and the early 20th century to revitalize these conventional roles. And that's why this attack on people who can get pregnant's bodies has become so virulent and so consistent under Trump, which is not to say that it started with Trump. It started in 1973 with Roe v. Wade, and even before, it was clear that that might happen. But its virulence and its focus and the dark money behind it is a political matter. It's a political matter for the people in the political class, and it's definitely a religious matter for some people. And the way these two groups are feeding off each other remains visible and in some ways inexplicable.
Before we go to break, I just wonder, are either of you surprised that so many young women are involved in this extreme anti-abortion movement?
Actually, I have to say that I don't know how many there are. I think some of them are getting press. I'm not sure how many and what percentage of young women are doing this. We do know that there are many, many hundreds of thousands, millions of young women who are involved in the reproductive justice movement. So, Crystal, do you have insight here?
I agree with you, Ricky. I think one of the things that is vital for me when I start to think about these things in social context is to really consider the networks that people are involved in and the access to information that people have, and also people's understandings of how important something is, not only for themselves, but for others. And as you said, Ricky, I don't know how many young women are involved on the anti-abortion side. But I do know that on the pro-abortion side of things, there are folks across age groups that are fighting for abortion access because they realize how crucial it is for everybody to have access to it. In fact, even those people who are against abortion, right? It's actually crucial that they have access to abortion too. And it's vital that there are folks out there doing the work so that even people that are fighting against abortion access have access to abortion if and when they need it.
Today, we're speaking with Crystal Littlejohn and Ricky Solinger, editors of the new book, Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. Crystal Littlejohn is associate professor at the University of Oregon. Ricky Solinger is a historian whose work focuses on reproductive politics. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Japanese-American activist Stanley Shikuma will discuss the movement to close a privately run immigrant detention center in Washington state. He says, we're fighting this now because we're determined to be the friends we wish we'd had in 1942. It's such a powerful statement. We hope you can join us for that show tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's conversation about reproductive rights and abortion, we're speaking with Crystal Littlejohn and Ricky Solinger, editors of Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. They write, the recriminalization of abortion in many states has ushered in heartache and constraint for those in need of abortion. But this period also shows us people fighting for reproductive freedom, mobilizing new strategies to help individuals live self-determined lives under the new local regime. This book shows that resistance is alive. Well, we have a number of, I really want to get into the book because the essays are so good. But we have a number of callers who've been waiting patiently. So let's take a few and then we'll get you both to respond. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. So the reason for my call is I live in San Francisco. I talk to a lot of young progressives it seems to me their focus is just this anger at Joe Biden specifically for not being sufficiently perfect and perfectly progressive in their view. And they are talking about maybe voting third party or staying home. And my question is to them and just to the universe, I guess, is if the universe, if abortion and bodily autonomy is so important to young progressives, then why are they not understanding that staying at home is basically helping Donald Trump and this Project 2025 and the right-wing agenda from prevailing? How do you get through to them?
I actually saw an interview with some women in Arizona who are independents, very pro-choice, but they said they don't like Biden, they don't like Trump, and they're considering RFK. So, I mean, there are so many stories like this across the country. Lisa, thank you so much for the important question. Let's take another caller and then we'll get responses. Let's go to Rochelle in San Francisco. Hi, Rochelle.
Hi. My question to people is, why are they not raising in the states where they're making abortion illegal? Where are their social services? Like, who's going to pay for the education of this child? Who's going to pay for the health care of this child? And on a darker side, the people that are forced to carry their baby to term, like, what are the incarceration rates in states where they're limiting abortion? It just, I don't know, it seems like the snake swallowing its own tail.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, I think the whole abortion movement got together because they could all agree, like, you know, from very conservative to super extremist, they could all agree on this moral, you know, fortitude of being anti-abortion, but they don't take it any further as far as, okay, well, who's going to pay for the baby once it's born? You know, who's going to pay for its education?
Yes, I'm sorry. I meant the second part of your question about jail.
Oh, on a darker note, so let's just say that the women of poverty are least likely to be able to, you know, obtain abortion. You know, and let's say their kid grows up unwanted and, you know, ultimately becomes incarcerated. It just seems to me like...
Right. I get exactly what you're saying. Thank you. Ricky, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I'd like to jump in because I think I sympathize profoundly with this woman's frustration, Lisa's frustration. But I think that what we are wanting to draw attention to is work that's being done within the framework of what we now call reproductive justice. And it so clearly addresses every one of the issues that the caller just raised, because reproductive justice says that access to abortion is crucial to safe, legal abortion is crucial in all of its forms, but it's nowhere near begins to meet the needs of people who have children or who are pregnant. I mean, when I think about what I needed in order to have a safe, dignified pregnancy and childbirth and child rearing situation, I needed safe housing. I needed access to health care. I needed to know that the schools that my children were going to go to would be good schools and safe schools. I needed to know that there wasn't a toxic dump in my neighborhood, and on. So the people who ally themselves with reproductive justice are doing the work that the caller names precisely. All of these things, we can't account for why the Republican Party and American conservatives want to cut back funding for social programs. We can't account for that. I mean, we can account for it philosophically or in some sense politically, but it's not our job to account for that. What we can do is organize and write about and represent the voices of people who are doing this work all over the country within a reproductive justice framework that recognizes how broad and deep the arenas of necessity are for people who are going to have children or who have children.
Crystal, do you have anything to add on that specific question?
Absolutely. I think to add on to what Ricky has just said, it's in my view, right, this question, it's not about morality, it's about cruelty, and it's not about compassion, it's about punishing people for accessing their human right to abortion and reproductive justice. And so when we start to see how the things that these folks are doing lead to these negative consequences, right? People not then having access to healthcare for their children, not having access to the resources to raise the children that they need in health, in healthy and safe environments. We can see that it's all part of a larger project that fails to consider the needs of people who get pregnant, who give birth, who have abortions, and who raise children. And that is that they fail to consider that is not surprising to me, given that the task of the whole project, in my view, is in part, as I mentioned earlier, to control the reproductive lives and futures of people who can get pregnant and who give birth, to inflict harm on them, as we've seen being done for centuries in this country. When we think about the reproductive experiences of Black women, of folks from marginalized backgrounds, of disabled people, right? We see that there's a longstanding history of violating their human rights and of violating their reproductive autonomy. And so this is just an extension of that longer history. And it doesn't at all surprise me that they're failing to make sure that people are being taken care of. And I would also say that even if there were services, right, even if they were fighting for services, that wouldn't make the assault on abortion any more okay, right? People need access to abortion. Abortion is a form of healthcare that is vital for people's lives. And even if folks try to come up with other services for people that are being forced to give birth, that isn't sufficient. We would still be doing a grave injustice to them. And so I think echoing what Rikia said, one of the key things that we wanted to do with this book is to really demonstrate that as there are folks who are failing to make sure that they're considering the needs of people whose rights they're violating, there are so many people who are doing just the opposite and are doing everything that they can to make sure that to the extent possible, they're providing resources, they're providing information, they're providing support in all of its forms so that people that need access to abortion can try and get it and live the lives that they deserve to have and that they have a right to access.
Well, Rochelle, thank you for the question, and we'll definitely continue to cover that. It's so important. What about Lisa's question? She said she comes into contact with people who are angry with Biden. I mean, we know that so many people are angry with Biden over, you know, what's happening in Gaza, over 31,000 Palestinians dead now. What are your thoughts? Some people say they're not going to vote. They're going to stay home. Other people say they don't like either candidate, so they might vote third party. Crystal or Ricky, do you want to take that one?
I'll just start by saying that there are, how many months until the election? It's a big job to do, and it's a job for activists and organizers all over the country who don't want Trump to be president again. We can't, idealism is the natural cloak of the young, right? So, you know, people get very focused on who a president is and what a president should do. There is no question that Biden has failed in some spectacular ways recently, especially in Gaza. But I mean, in many ways, it always bemuses me to imagine who young people in particular, but many people think a president is. Who was a president who didn't break your heart in the last, and you over the course of your lifetime? Who was that person? I don't know who that person was. I never had that experience in my long life. So I think it's a matter of organizing. It's a matter of paying attention to that challenge and getting results.
Well, thank you for that question, Lisa. I want to ask you both, we're almost out of time, so we're going to have you back to talk more about your book. I just wonder how you think about these issues? Because I know that so many people struggle with this. I just want to read a couple headlines from recent articles. Vice: domestic abusers are using abortion bans to control their victims. CNN: nearly 65,000 pregnancies from rape have occurred in states with abortion bans. The Texas Tribune: she was told her twin sons wouldn't survive. Texas law made her give birth anyway. And then, of course, the horrific story, The Guardian: a 13-year-old girl gives birth after she was raped and denied an abortion in Mississippi. And I also just want to say, because I feel like the media tend to focus on, and there's nothing wrong with this, the women who wanted their children, who had a fetal anomaly, and then were not able to get an abortion. And those stories are horrific, and I'm glad they're getting attention. But the stories that aren't getting attention are the people who just got pregnant and don't want to be pregnant. Those stories are also just as important, and I think it's important to highlight that. So you've got all of that, but then in your book, I mean, what is it, 51 essays by people who are doing such important work on the ground, and they're definitely not getting, you know, CBS, NBC media coverage. So how do you think about this right now, where these stories are horrific, and yet, as you both say, there's so much activism happening on the ground right now? Ricky?
Well, I was hoping Crystal would take this.
Crystal, sure.
Thanks, Ricky. I would say, I think one of the things that is so crucial for me is really taking heart in what people are doing without any fanfare. And what we see in the book, and what was really important for me, was to shed light on their strategies and shed light on their approaches and their courage. Because as you said, Rose, we don't see this. We don't see a lot of the work that's being done on the main stage. We don't see the work that the folks in the book have been doing behind the scenes, and that they were doing behind the scenes in the aftermath of the Dobbs decision, but also that they were doing before the Dobbs decision was handed down. And that work is crucial, because they're supporting their communities, and they've long been supporting their communities without public attention, and they're not doing it because they want or need public attention. And so from a reproductive justice perspective, it is one of those things that makes me think about the power of activism and the importance of activism, because as I was just speaking about a few minutes ago, we know that the United States has a long history of violating people's rights, whether that's their reproductive rights, whether that's their rights as citizens of the United States more broadly. And we also know that as long as that's been happening, there have also been people fighting against it. And so it makes me think of the previous question a little bit, actually, in just trying to puzzle through how people respond to things, and also in really making sure that, even as I believe that activism is going to always be the way of the future to hold courts accountable for protecting the rights of their citizens, it's also just crucial that people that are in power listen to the folks on the ground that are telling them about their rights being violated, and that they actually respond to that and do what they should do to make sure that their citizens are being protected.
I just want to add to that a couple of really concrete examples of the kinds of people we invited, the kinds of work they're doing, who we invited to participate in the book. I'm thinking of the person who's a labor organizer, who wrote about abortion and reproductive health care as a labor issue, and how her work as an organizer absolutely depends on people who need reproductive health care getting it. I'm thinking about the several people who are writing essays in the book who are religious leaders, who are talking about the kind of work they're doing in their congregations and communities around how unfair it is that only one religious perspective is being articulated on the court and given respect, and many other religious perspectives are not. I'm thinking about the organization that's created a training manual for social workers and attorneys and other people who are giving advice and guidance on the ground to professionals who are dealing with impacts and outcomes of Dobbs. And finally, the final example I'll give here is a professor in Texas who has to give out her syllabus in the beginning of the term. And how is she going to not break the law and yet give her students the information they need in order to be able to access the kinds of reproductive health care and other kinds of health care that they need and other kinds of services that they need? So, I mean, this is all over the map. It's people in so many different locations with so many different forms of expertise and energy to offer. So this, in some ways, this book is a document of the first year plus after Dobbs, in which just people got to work. And there were DAs who said, we're not going to prosecute in states where illegality went into force immediately. There are Pennsylvania politicians. The Kansas referendum is fully documented by people who invented it. So it's so interesting to move around the country in Oklahoma and Appalachia and see what people are doing.
Well, it's such an important book. Thank you both for writing it. And we'd love to have you back to continue this discussion to bring these stories to light. Ricky Solinger and Crystal Littlejohn are editors of the new book, Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. Crystal Littlejohn is associate professor at the University of Oregon. You can check out her last book called Just Get on the Pill, The Uneven Burden of Reproductive Politics. Ricky Solinger is a historian. She's written and edited many books, including Wake Up, Little Susie, Single Pregnancy, and Race Before Roe v. Wade. Learn more about their work at yourcallradio.org. Crystal and Ricky, thank you so much, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote for producing today's show and Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.